Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war is, of course, waged on the home front as well as overseas, and one of the spaces that it seems to me we ought to be paying attention to is the degree to which we may be contributing to a degree of lawlessness and increased criminality, ironically, by trying, in the name of criminal justice reform, to turn loose many people who are currently incarcerated on drug crime offenses. A man who has quite courageously spoken out about this problem, in fact testified before the United States Congress on the subject, is our first guest, Steve Cook. He is the president of the National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys. He is currently the chief of the criminal division in the Eastern District of Tennessee, has been involved in this line of work for 29 years, and has also had a seven-year career on the front lines as a police officer in Knoxville, Tennessee. He is joining us in his personal capacity, not in connection with his official duties, needless to say, but we're very, very pleased to have him with us to talk about this criminal justice reform initiative. Steve Cook, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm honored to be with you.
You testified recently that there seem to be myths and misleading anecdotes that are driving this now bipartisan push to change minimal sentencing arrangements and other aspects of the law. How would you characterize those myths and misleading anecdotes?
Well, there are many myths, and in fact, with respect to the anecdotes, it seems that the entire move is driven by exceptions, not the rule. They've paraded a number of cases where the system seems to have been overreaching instead of looking at the successes we've had.
And the successes you would define as what?
Well, the successes are huge. These statutes were passed. The statutes that are now at issue were passed in the mid-80s. Of course, we were in the mid-80s in the midst of a crime wave. Violent crime and other crime had more than tripled over the preceding 2.5 decades. Congress passed these statutes to do something about it, and it shouldn't surprise anybody that it worked. We started taking serious drug traffickers and violent criminals off the street and putting them in a federal penitentiary. As a result, from 1991 to 2014, violent crime has been cut more than in half. That's a huge success.
And Steve, one of the other things that seems to be at operation here is that there is some effort being made, and I can't quite tell whether it's deliberately misleading or innocently so, but to suggest that drug trafficking isn't inherently violent. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the refrain that we hear from the reformers is one about over-incarcerating, quote, nonviolent drug offenders. Of course, what we're talking about in the federal system is some very high-level narcotics traffickers, not low-level violent, nonviolent offenders. And to your point, there are two things that are implied by their refrain. One is that drug trafficking isn't serious. Two, that it's nonviolent. Both are nonsense. We've got, with respect to the seriousness of the crime, we've got a heroin epidemic, an opioid addiction epidemic that is killing, and in fact, last year over 43,000 people died from that.
Yeah, in fact, the president of the United States, as I recall, was just this week in West Virginia railing against this problem of opioid addiction, and it does seem as though there's a kind of schizophrenia here. On the one hand, very much and properly so, being concerned about the effects, and yet it would seem, contributing to a resurgence of it, an intensification of it, because as I understand it, and again, our guest is Stephen Cook. He is an assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Tennessee, speaking to us in a personal capacity, but also the president of the National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys. It does seem as though the line that we're being given is that somehow there isn't any connection between turning these folks loose and having a heightened degree of criminal activity because of the high rates of recidivism associated with this. And I'd like to ask you to address that. You know, how bad is the recidivism rate? That is to say, the propensity of these folks to return to criminal activity. And you ask the question, why the rush in making these changes that would perhaps turn quite large numbers of these folks loose?
Well, and both of those are important points. To your first one, and that is the recidivism rates, the most recent Bureau of Justice statistics reflect a recidivism rate of about 77%. That of course, should give everybody great pause about releasing more and more drug traffickers. As to that point, too, it's important for the public to know that the Sentencing Commission, through a series of changes in the sentencing guidelines, has already promulgated rules that have resulted in the release, the orders for early release of about 24,000 drug traffickers. The media has been much more active in reporting the next wave, because the next wave involves sentence reductions for 46,000 drug traffickers. Those are huge numbers when you're talking about early releasing them into our community, knowing what the recidivism rates are.
And knowing that there is, in fact, at least the violence being perpetrated by having lives destroyed by these drugs, and in all likelihood as well, a possibility of other kinds of violent behavior to boot. Let me ask you about what seems to be motivating this. And again, I know this is your personal opinion, but I'm just keen to try to figure out, given that it would seem we should take our time and see how this works out, if 6 or 8,000, let alone 46,000 of these guys are going to be, and I think they're disproportionately men, but they're going to be turned loose on our society. Is this really basically about kind of a sop to this whole notion that blacks have been unfairly treated in this business and kind of playing into that whole Black Lives Matter meme, Stephen Cook?
Well, I think you make a good point, and there has been a lot of concern, and there should be a lot of concern about the impact on minority communities, because minorities have been disproportionately incarcerated under these laws. But to suggest that the system has acted inappropriately, I think, is flawed for a number of reasons. First of all, we all know how the criminal justice system works. Congress looks at criminal behavior, things that are going wrong in society, and they pass statutes to criminalize it. The executive branch then enforces it, and the judiciary sentences people. Now, although people have looked at this extensively, nowhere in the process, they looked at the legislative enactment, and no evidence of any bias. In fact, it was these laws were passed with wide bipartisan support. Secondly, on the executive enforcement, no evidence of any bias in the enforcement. What we have is a disparate impact. That is, that the minority communities have been impacted disproportionately. What's important to remember about that is those minority communities were disproportionately impacted by the crime. Turning that around, they have been far and away the beneficiaries of the incarceration that's occurred as a result of these.
Let me just close by saying, Stephen Cook, I appreciate so much your leadership in expressing the concerns of those like you in the criminal justice system, because it seems at least in part, if not intentionally, certainly in part, the repercussions of this are going to be to discredit the fairness and the utility of the criminal justice system. And it hardly seems as though that's something we should be doing at this point, further undermining really the rule of law itself. We have to let you go for the moment, but I do hope we'll be able to continue this conversation with you as this very important legislative initiative hopefully gets more scrutiny in the future. We thank you for what you are doing at the National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys, Stephen Cook, and in the Eastern District of Tennessee. Keep up the good work, and thank you for your time today. Peter Pham joins us next. We'll get an update on Boko Haram in Africa and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Dr. Peter Pham. He is a duty expert for us and many others on Africa, a subject on which he is deeply knowledgeable. He works as the director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. His latest book is about one of those African countries, Somalia, Fixing Africa's Most Failed State. It is always good to have a chance to catch up with him about matters that are generally not getting the attention they deserve, it seems to me, in Africa, and we're delighted to be able to do it with him. Peter, thanks so much for taking some time. Good to have you.
Always a pleasure to speak with you, Frank.
You have been quoted recently in connection with a very troubling practice of a jihadist group known as Boko Haram, now operating in, seems, in maybe four or five countries in Africa. This is not the only horrible thing that they are doing, but what are the implications for the people of the countries affected, that their children are being enslaved and you know, forced to fight for Boko?
Well, Frank, let's put this in a little bit of context. This is not actually new to Boko Haram. Boko Haram has, throughout its history, but especially in its virulent jihadist insurgency phase, which I date to roughly 2013, when the French military intervention against various jihadist groups, including some linked with al-Qaeda in northern Mali, drove them from their refuges and training camps back to Nigeria, and they adopted a strategy of seizing, trying to seize and hold territory. Since that time, they've used children in a variety of fashions, exploited them. Of course, most famously, the schoolgirls from Chibok who were kidnapped en masse, various other kidnappings of women and girls. In fact, they so pioneered that tactic that Daesh or ISIL, ISIS, whatever you want to call them, the so-called Islamic State, in their magazine Dabiq, actually singled out Boko Haram and cited them as a precedent for the outrages that they're carrying out against Yazidi and other religious minority.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Pham about Africa, a continent that is his field of expertise at the Atlantic Council, where he directs its Africa Center. And Peter, you were just talking about the ties between the Islamic State, which President Obama has declared an enemy of this country, and it's kind of the franchise, I guess it is now, that it has in Africa, Boko Haram. It's holding it up as an exemplary of the kind of jihadism that it aspires to in the Middle East. Of course, we have recently seen the deployment of American forces in some number into Cameroon to help the countries now under assault from Boko contend with this threat. Talk a little bit about that deployment, what it's supposed to do, its size, and what prospects you think it has for success.
Well, Frank, we continue to call it Boko Haram. It's the most common name, but it's worth noting that the group itself, since it pledged allegiance, since allegiance was accepted by al-Baghdadi back earlier this year, Boko Haram itself calls itself ISWAP, Islamic State West Africa Province. So there's a very close alignment there. And while the group itself, the subgroup of the Islamic State, is not a direct threat to the United States, except perhaps aspirationally, it's certainly a growing regional security threat to a number of our allies. So most recently, President Obama notified Congress that he was deploying up to 300 U.S. military personnel to Cameroon, a country that has come under attack, including recently by child soldiers enslaved or recruited by Boko Haram. The first batch, approximately 90 U.S. military personnel, already are on the ground there to fly unmanned aerial vehicles, Predators specifically, to gather intelligence on the cross-border movements of Boko Haram, to establish some baselines, to gather information. Other personnel arriving in the coming weeks will engage in training the Cameroonian military. The Cameroonian military actually has a very strong unit, the so-called Rapid Reaction Force, known by its French acronym BIR, which originally was actually trained and equipped and led by Israelis, but since 2009 has been receiving training from the SEALs and other U.S. Special Operations Forces. But they were trained to deal with some disorders and insurgencies down on the coast. Now they have to be kind of retrained. They're already well qualified, but retrained for desert warfare against Boko Haram. So it's training partner militaries in the region to fight against Boko Haram. And we have to kind of work around Nigeria for the moment. Nigeria, there are a number of issues that still remain. There's been a new president elected, but there are a number of issues that remain. So right now we have to work with the neighboring countries to at least contain the threat. And then eventually, hopefully, we can work with the Nigerians to build up their capacity.
To the extent that this is a project, I assume, of the U.S. Africa Command, Peter, how is that command now being perceived in the theater? Is it considered, you know, of value to those nations now under assault, or is there still a certain hands or arm's length relationship being followed by them?
Well, the countries that are being assisted have had good partnerships with the U.S. Military and AFRICOM in particular. Cameroon, as I mentioned, has had special operations forces helping train up their one crack unit. Niger, which has been under assault by Boko Haram and has been resisting, has long cooperated. In fact, every spring it plays host to an annual exercise in the Sahel led by AFRICOM, but also involving special operations forces and various other units known as Flintlock. So Niger is a strong partner with the U.S. It hosts a number of U.S. military bases that fly drones to survey not only the Sahel, but areas northward. So it's a strong partner of ours. Chad, there's a partnership there, although the partnership there is led heavily by the French, who also have an anti-terrorism base in that country. So the U.S. and its allies have strong partnerships in the countries around Nigeria. We're just ramping them up to deal with this ever-growing threat from what is now a province of the Islamic State.
Yeah, the caliphate, indeed. And Peter, in closing, just do you anticipate, given what we know about this Islamist caliphate and agenda, that we are likely to see the United States assuming larger responsibilities, in fact, a war-fighting role, a mission creep, I guess is the term often assigned to it, that might move well beyond the rather limited mission that you described a moment ago.
I can see perhaps a growing intelligence, perhaps a growing advisory capacity, but we have allies in the region who are willing to contribute troops, some of which have been U.S. armed and equipped, some French armed and equipped. So we don't need the boots on the ground so much as, if you will, the higher order war fighting skills, intelligence, planning, strategy, doctrine in counterinsurgency and countering jihadist plots and in that sense also bleeding over into police and law enforcement issues. So it's really a matter of capacity building right now. Now, that's a dynamic situation. Things may change. But right now, I don't really see a boots-on-the-ground effort, at least here, if we ramp up sufficiently to nip this. This is a new province of the Islamic State, but it hasn't acquired the lethality of certainly the caliphate in its main base back in Syria and Iraq.
Well, let us hope that we can prevent that from taking place. There is evidence that the jihadists have their eyes on lots of places in the continent on which you focus so handsomely, Dr. Peter Pham, including apparently the leader of Hamas with some of his colleagues in South Africa. But that's a topic I hope for another day with you. In the meantime, thank you so much for your time today. Keep up the great work at the Atlantic Council and come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Congressman Doug Lamborn about the National Defense Authorization Act and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, the president vetoed the annual legislation used to authorize defense programs and the pay and benefits for our troops. Unfortunately, this is but the latest manifestation of the Obama doctrine that emboldens our enemies, undermines our friends, and diminishes our country. He's upset that the bill would interfere with his insistence on bringing jihadists from Guantanamo Bay into the United States. Congress has repeatedly determined, usually by lopsided bipartisan majorities, that would pose an unacceptable risk to the national security. President Obama also refuses to reverse his hollowing out of the military unless Congress spends more on already bloated non-defense programs. Mr. Obama may be indifferent to the cumulative impact of the havoc he is wreaking at home and abroad, but Congress cannot be. It must provide for the common defense and override this veto. This is Frank Gaffney. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Doug Lamborn, a man who I've had the privilege of knowing and working with now for quite some time, from his perspective as a representative of the people of the 5th District in Colorado, a member of the House Armed Services Committee, vice chairman of its Strategic Forces Subcommittee, also a member of the House Committee on Natural Resources, Veterans Affairs, a very, very important and influential legislator. We're always delighted to have him with us, especially on the occasion of the president's veto of one of your major legislative initiatives, Congressman Lamborn, the National Defense Authorization Act. Welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Well, Frank, I appreciate the work you do to promote our national security.
Thanks. Let's talk about this National Defense Authorization Act. It's not every day that the President of the United States wields his veto pen to strike this legislation down. Remind our listeners, Doug, if you would, what's this bill about? Why is it important? And then we'll talk about why the President has seen fit to veto it.
There are two bills that deal with the military each year. The first is the authorization bill, which this is, which describes all of the programs, sometimes new programs that have to be opened up, or modifications in existing programs, other changes, and then the appropriators give the money for, in a separate bill, for all of those changes, and they might even have some input as well on where the dollars go, and the two of those make the package. This president has vetoed the NDAA, the Authorization Act for this year, and the first time in history it's ever been vetoed for something that's not even in the bill itself.
Hmm. This is sort of the crux of the matter, I think. But there is one provision of this legislation that apparently the president found particularly objectionable. And it happens that at least it sounds as though the administration has Colorado in mind as a place that would have bearing on this objection. Give us a flavor of the legislation's current treatment of the Guantanamo Bay prison and the disposition of its jihadist detainees, and why the president seems to be interested in your state as a place to put them.
I know that this is a specific thing in the bill. The other issue is he just wants to get more funding for outside projects in other parts of the budget unrelated to the military, and that shouldn't even be a reason for veto. But on this issue, and we will come back to that, but on Gitmo itself, Frank, like you pointed out, the bill says there will be no funds for no ability, a power to transfer these people to U.S. soil. And the president does not like that. He wants to shut down Guantanamo Bay. He feels like that's an incitement to people that just hate our way of life. Even if he had his way, God forbid, they would find other reasons, and they have other reasons to hate us because of their perverse philosophy. So, Frank, it's not going to help at all. In fact, it'll do a lot of harm. You send these people to U.S. soil, you'll have federal judges giving them constitutional rights, which will make it almost impossible to try them because it'll force the disclosure of methods and operations that we use for our most sensitive intelligence gathering. They'll get into prison, into the civilian population, and start radicalizing. There will be security threats. People will find ways to do harm to our facilities and our personnel, some of whom are my constituents, because they want to bring some of these people possibly to Colorado even. So, Frank, it's just bad on so many fronts.
What kinds of prisons are they talking about possibly putting them in Colorado? I saw one, I think, was a state penitentiary. Is it your judgment, Congressman Doug Lamborn, that those facilities are going to be adequate to deal with threats from perhaps outside to them, or certainly to the safe incarceration of these guys, even if the federal judges don't muck things up?
Frank, I think whether they can be sprung loose, I don't know about that. If the bad guys could pull that off, but they could certainly bring violence and death to the people guarding the place, going to work in these places, coming home from work at these places.
The surrounding communities, too.
Yeah, they could give it their best shot and do a lot of damage. Whether they would actually spring people free, that I don't know. There is a state and federal facility both that they're looking at.
Yeah. This is ill-advised in the extreme, and the bipartisan majorities that have consistently been blocking this kind of action are, you know, the sort of thing that you'd think would cause the president to relent, but he seems to be doubling down. Let's turn to the other issue that you raised, Congressman Doug Lamborn, and you're right, it is outrageous that the president seems to be trying essentially to euchre further, well, pork barrel spending, perhaps you might call it, or at least additional domestic spending that may or may not be justified on the backs of our military personnel. How is that being seen by members of Congress? I would think that that would be an affront even for some Democrats who've recognized the importance of this legislation.
Well, Frank, there was a lot of support in both the House and the Senate by Democrats for the NDAA as it passed. So there's a fighting chance of getting an override, which takes two-thirds of both the House and the Senate. In fact, the Senate vote was more than two-thirds. But we fell a little bit short in the House, but well over a majority, well over 50%. The fact that he wants leverage, he's using our men and women in uniform and our national security as a pawn to leverage his demand that we spend more money on his pet projects. And the American people are sick and tired of the IRS, the EPA, these bureaucracies running roughshod over us, and they don't want to give them even more money. But yet the president and the looming $18 trillion plus national debt that we have to get spending under control. He's going in the opposite direction, on the backs of our military.
Amen. Congressman, let me turn to one other provision in this legislation, the National Defense Authorization Act, with which I know you have been particularly involved. You represent some of the people most immediately providing for our space capabilities, particularly national security space capabilities out in Colorado. What is going on, as you see it, with respect to threats to our ability to operate in the high frontier, as it's been called, and to, if necessary, project power from there? And, you know, the counterpart efforts being made by those who might deny us such capabilities, notably Communist China.
Well, Frank, space used to be a sanctuary. It is no longer a sanctuary. We know that China and, to a lesser extent, Russia have tremendous capabilities that could do harm to key assets we have in space for communications, for intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and for other vital military missions for our warfighters and for our security, you know, detecting incoming possible, you know, God forbid, nuclear ballistic missiles. There are all kinds of things we need space for, and our near peers, China and Russia, are very well aware of what our assets are, and now they're developing the technology to do something about it, and we have to fight back.
And what does the Defense Authorization Bill do in that regard to assure that we have, in fact, the kind of capabilities we need for space control?
Well, General Hyten, who runs Space Command, has a major new initiative to expand our ability to do just this, to develop the capabilities to stay in front technologically of what the Russians and Chinese are trying to do. And if we veto this bill and it's sustained, we don't know, we can't initiate new programs or do major modifications of existing programs. We just have to, at best, continue with existing programs in a rigid, lockstep fashion without any amendments or changes possible. And even there, funding becomes an issue because funding might run out. So we are in deep trouble if the president gets his way. He's playing with our national security in a dangerous way, Frank.
At a dangerous time. Congressman Doug Lamborn of the 5th District of Colorado, I salute you for your leadership, particularly on trying to get a major force program introduced here on the space control front, both to deter our adversaries and to assure our security and our economic well-being, as you say. Keep up that good work, sir. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. In the meantime, we appreciate all that you're doing. And Stephen Groves from the Heritage Foundation joins us next to talk about the evisceration of the Senate's role in treaty making and what it might mean for you. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined, I'm very pleased to say, once again by another old and very valued friend and colleague. He is Stephen Groves, a senior research fellow at the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom of the Heritage Foundation. He has, in previous incarnations, served both at the state and federal level in our government, notably at, in the state of Florida as an assistant attorney general and in the United States Senate on the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, where he was a senior counsel. Stephen Groves is one of the country's preeminent experts and great practitioners of public policy concerning international diplomacy and agreements, and it is always a treat to have him with us. Steve, welcome back. It's good to have you.
Great to be back, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Well, there are several things I'm anxious to talk with you about. Much mischief is afoot at the moment. You have been very focused and writing powerfully about what the president and his team are doing in Paris, or in the run-up, I should say, to Paris later this year with respect to climate change. Is it reasonable to expect that we'll see a kind of reprise of what was done on the Iran deal, namely just simply blowing past the Senate what should be a treaty and what should, for that matter, be rejected by the Senate as such?
Yeah, not just a reprise, but if you can believe it, this is really going to be kind of a greater overstep than the Iran deal was. At least with the Iran deal, you know, the majority of what happened would happen overseas. It would happen in Iran with the inspections and the reductions and all the things the Iranians have promised on a stack of Korans that they're going to do. What makes this Paris Protocol, what is what we're calling it, even worse, is that he's going to go make all these international promises overseas in Paris to the rest of the world, and then he's going to come back here to the United States and enforce those promises through, you know, very onerous environmental regulations and bypass the Senate altogether. So there's going to be significant domestic impact on Americans, on how they consume energy and how they produce energy based on the president's international commitments, all without the Senate or the House having any say.
So you'll see neither the treaty-making process used to get ratification of the treaty. You'll see the Congress sidestepped even further with respect to the kind of implementing legislation that, as you say, Stephen Groves, could be extraordinarily not just onerous but expensive as well. Is there any sign of life from the United States Congress that this sort of overstepping is not going to be tolerated on this agreement, even though they did effectively rubber stamp or at least took a dive on the most recent unpleasantness with respect to Iran in this regard?
In a word, no. And it's extremely, extremely disheartening. At a minimum, someone like Senator Bob Corker from Tennessee should hold a hearing at Senate Foreign Relations Committee and call, you know, the key negotiators from the administration and say, hey, what is exactly are you guys planning on doing in Paris, and why, from your press statements, is it crystal clear that you have no intention of giving Senate any type of review on this agreement? That's what the Senate, at a bare minimum, should be doing. But what they did instead is Senator Barrasso, who chairs a subcommittee under the Foreign Relations Committee, held a hearing on Tuesday where he and he alone from the Republican side of the aisle showed up and tried to put up a good fight, but he was one man, whereas five Democrats showed up on the other side. And this was the one crack at questioning Todd Stern, who is the president's number one climate change negotiator on the agreements. So I see no sign from either the Senate or the House that they even know what's going on, much less they're prepared to do anything about it.
And you served with distinction in the Senate on the staff of a subcommittee with which I had worked a long time ago, as a matter of fact, myself. And I can't imagine what the framers would think of the Senate going along with this extraordinary reduction in its responsibilities and authority. And Steve, I guess the question occurs, will there be any limit going forward to what this president or perhaps future presidents might do, having effectively eviscerated this constitutional check and balance, whereby the framers said to the executive, you will have a quality control mechanism by having to get two-thirds of the Senate to go along with whatever international agreements you fashion?
I see no reason why future presidents, and particularly liberal Democrat future presidents, should we be so blessed to have it, would not follow Obama's precedent here. I mean, after all, why bother going through the messy advice and consent process that the framers put into the Constitution, where you have to get, you know, a supermajority of the Senate to agree to an international agreement, when you can just agree to the agreement over in Paris or Geneva or wherever these things get negotiated, and then come back and unilaterally enforce them by executive diktat? I mean, why not, when you've got the comprehensive test ban treaty that we know we can't get through the Senate, already failed in the Senate once, why not just enforce it through executive orders and regulations? How about human rights treaties? Can't get those through the Senate either because people are concerned about sovereignty and being governed from Geneva. Why not just have new regs on those as well and rule from the White House the way that George III used to rule from the throne in London?
You know, you mentioned the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, or CTBT, Stephen Groves, and it is, of course, something that has just reared its ugly head again. The president's top diplomat, John Kerry, announcing earlier this week that he is determined to try to get this treaty through the Senate as a treaty. And certainly it failed miserably back in 99, I think, or 2000, a long time ago. But they're going to take another run at it, I guess, through the treaty-making process. But we'll see. I look forward to working with you in opposition to that. But before we run out of time, let me ask you quickly about one other treaty that you have been extraordinarily effective in opposing for a lot of reasons, and that is the Law of the Sea Treaty. When you see a member state like China engaging in the kind of behavior it is at the moment in the South China Sea, utterly in violation of the Law of the Sea Treaty, do you think that that will be the end of this idea that we too should become party to it?
Time will tell. You and I and our allies were so effective in killing this treaty back in 2012 that the idea that it would be brought up in the Senate anytime soon would be very surprising. But we also thought that CTBT was dead. These are the zombie treaties that you and I always talk about. You know, as many times as you kill them, they tend to come back. But, I mean, you and I have advocated against this treaty for so long. And one of the reasons that we bring up is, hey, the countries that count and many other countries around the world, they don't even follow the treaty that they are a party to. Why do we want to join a treaty where we don't have reliable treaty partners who flout the black letter law of the treaty? And that's what we're seeing in the South China Sea with China and ignoring the lawsuit that the Philippines brought against it under the treaty, validly under the treaty, through their reclamation of rocks in the South China Sea and starting to call them islands and then saber-rattling about it.
And declaring keep-out zones and then the question of whether we will exercise freedom of navigation operations and possibly come into conflict with the Chinese. An extraordinarily important strategic development. And Steve Groves, I'm so grateful to you for all of your efforts to help expose the rest of us to what's at stake with these international accords, and particularly the possibility that they will be imposed upon us outside of the regular order, as they say. Keep up the good work, my friend, that you do at the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom at the Heritage Foundation, and come back to us again very soon. Next up, Tariq Fatah will join us from Canada, talking about the victory, perhaps for Islam.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us. Friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I couldn't be more pleased to say, joined by a friend of many years now, Tariq Fatah, a courageous Muslim in Canada, who has very much been a thorn in the side of Islamic supremacists there and has spoke, I think, quite courageously about what they're up to and why they must be resisted. Alas, I fear, the effect of the election in Canada may have very much the contrary effect, and we wanted to catch up with Tariq and talk with him about that. He is a columnist for the Toronto Sun, the author of Chasing a Mirage, The Tragic Illusion of an Islamic State. He also founded and is still associated with a most important organization, the Muslim Canadian Congress. Tarek, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm sorry it's on this occasion, I must say. I did not think the outcome of the election was salutary, but I wanted to get your thoughts on it. And in particular, I spoke with one of your colleagues up there, a columnist for the National Post, Barbara Kay, yesterday, and she thought that the issue that broke late in the campaign about this face covering, the Muslim niqab, as it's called, played a factor in how the election came out. Did you agree?
Well, in a very indirect manner, because you know the party that was leading the polls, which is left of center New Democrats, who had a very stronghold in Quebec, which has a different political climate than the rest of English Canada. There, the leader of the NDP, in defending the right of Muslim women to cover their faces, boomeranged on him. And as a consequence, he lost 50 seats in that riding. Now the votes, because we have a parliamentary system here, there was a four-way split. There were four political parties in Quebec, and unfortunately, most of the vote that vanished from under the NDP went to a very well-crafted campaign by this young man, Justin Trudeau, and that triggered yes, and for the Liberal Party, and that gave him a very strong base over there.
But Justin Trudeau's position was similar, was it not, on the question of the niqab?
Absolutely, but as far as the NDP's position, it was perhaps, although I completely disagree, principled. The Liberal position usually was to measure the wind and go with the flow. So it's a very unprincipled party. Most people who join it are go there to look for favors. I've flirted with them for a few years, and I found that there was hardly any young liberal who joined the party for any conviction other than that it would be good for his or her career.
Let me ask you specifically, because you have been active in political affairs and policy, particularly with respect to the state of play with respect to Canadian freedoms and rights and those within the Muslim community, I call them Islamic supremacists, who would force them to submit, basically, to Sharia. Tariq Fatah, what are the implications, as you see it now, of Trudeau and his expediency-driven party for your struggle in this regard?
It's been a setback for us. Clearly, I won't mince words. My fear is that in the parliament that we have now, there is a Saudi-born member of parliament. There are two members who I clearly identify as representatives of the Iranian regime. Plus, there are two who are very close to the Pakistani embassy. So you now have at least, I would say, six or seven people. Few of them could end up in cabinet because what is it? The cabinet that the prime minister has committed to needs 50% women. And if you are a woman of color plus an immigrant plus a Muslim, chances are you'd be sitting in one of these women will be sitting in his cabinet. So it's dangerous. And you will imagine that his first action without being sworn in wants to tell President Obama that he's pulling himself out of the fight against the Islamic State. And it was highly symbolic. And it has never been Canada's history to ever retreat from a fight.
There is talk that Justin Trudeau will also throw open Canada's doors to immigration from particularly countries where this this sort of Sharia agenda is very much in evidence. There is also this question. You were speaking about Quebec a moment ago. We've talked earlier in the week with others about this Quebec Bill 59 and its implications for freedom of speech, seemingly something that the new government will be sympathetic to that bill. Give us a flavor of is that a correct assessment as you see it, and what, again, the implications may be.
Immigration is not an issue to that extent. What is really the problem is his promise to bring in 25,000 refugees before the end of this year, which means we could soon have cruise ships, airlines, Canadian military aircraft, just going there and picking up whatever they can find, whoever they can find, and flying them into Canada. It's a huge task, but he last night said that, yes, he's going to do it. You have to understand, he's not a very smart guy. His father was also equally anti-American as he is, but his father was a smart, educated person. Our Prime Minister Trudeau Jr. has never cleared any university. He's dropped out from engineering, dropped out from business administration, never ever held a 9-to-5 job, and he went straight as a pretty boy who's won boxing matches and does wrestling and dancing and is more of a sex symbol and is now the Prime Minister.
Let me ask you about this, because one aspect of this trick that is particularly troubling, I mean, the background of this individual is troubling enough, but one of the things that our Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI, has now said on several different occasions, including its director just this week, is that we have no way of vetting those in Syria who might be considered refugees and brought to this country. Our president has committed to bringing large numbers of them as well, as you know. Is that a concern in Canada? And if not, why not?
I think most North Americans are essentially very decent people, and they have no clue of the deceptive nature of the Islamist. This is not bringing people in from Congo. You can imagine, millions have died there. Nobody ever asks for flying in those folks. These are people who, even in their worst state, are wearing state-of-the-art hijabs and designer jeans. You must have seen all these refugees who are paying enormous amounts of money to people smugglers. We are not talking of the North African boat people coming into Italy. We are talking about Syrian.
Tariq Fattah, this is a subject for a much longer conversation. We're hard out of time at the moment, but thank you for your insights today, and let's do this again soon. In the meantime, keep up your very important work, among other places, at the Muslim Canadian Congress and the Toronto Sun. I hope the rest of you will join us again Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afton. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.